From the new book, Coming Apart, quote, "If the case I have made is completely correct, all is lost," close quote. With us today, Charles Murray, who I believe will join me in hoping that he is not completely correct. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, shooting today in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Robinson. One of the country's leading social scientists, Charles Murray, is a longtime fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, right here in Washington, author of books that include Losing Ground, What It Means to Be a Libertarian, In Our Hands, A Plan to Replace the Welfare State, and The Bell Curve. Dr. Murray has just published Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. David Brooks of the New York Times, quote, "I'll be shocked if there's another book this year as important as Charles Murray's Coming Apart." Charles Murray, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Segment one, What We've Lost. Coming Apart, quote, November 22, 1963 became the symbolic first day of what would be known as the 60s. The symbolic last day of the culture that preceded it was November 21st, 1963. We'll come to a detailed picture. I hope we have time to flesh it out in a moment. But first, can you reduce to a sentence or two what my children, what people who have no memory of those days need to know about the world that ended on November 21st, 1963?
There's nothing scarier than being asked to reduce to a sentence or two anything. I guess the sentence or two are this. First sentence is, I don't want to go back to 1963. I'd have to be dragged back there kicking and screaming because lots of good things have happened since then. Point number one. The second sentence is, however, there were things that we had in 1963 that we are in danger of losing irrevocably, and that is what is known as America's civic culture. Because in 1963, we had a common civic culture transcending rich and poor that was the direct descendant of the civic culture that the founders set up with the Constitution.
The living, felt culture of the country was that, still directly in touch with
exactly. The founders. Peter, we still use the phrase the American way of life then. When was the last time you heard that, you know, in common use in the United States now? We don't talk about it anymore. Mm-hmm. But in 1963, people all knew what you meant when you said the American way of life.
On November 21st, 1963, the state of the American family, marriage rates, illegitimacy rate.
Everybody was married. Now, I'm going to refer in all of our conversations to non-Latino whites, and I might as well say quickly why I'm doing that.
Please.
I'm going to be talking about social problems, and when you do that, when you include everybody, the natural response is to say, well, maybe Murray's really talking mostly about problems that are located in the African-American community, right, or perhaps it's a problem of illegal immigration. Non-Latino whites, as the base of your numbers, concentrates the mind wonderfully,
right,
in terms of coming to grips with these problems, which I think it has succeeded in doing, judging from the reaction to the book. Anyway, you asked about marriage. If you had a high school educated blue collar person in 1963 who was ages 30 to 49, the odds were 84% that he was married, and the same, of course, for the women. In other words, it was the overwhelming norm. It was a little higher among the college-educated who were working in the professions. It was 94%, but it was the norm throughout society. 2010, you are down to 84% for the upper middle class, which is still quite high. You're down to 48% for the white working class. I mean, that is a sea change in a central cultural institution that has almost no precedent that I know of over such a short period of time.
Anywhere in human history?
I can't think of any where you've had such a central institution that's undergone such a profound change.
November 21st, 1963, workforce participation.
Let's talk about guys, because women at that time still were expected to stay home and keep the house and all that. If you were a guy and you were in your 30s and 40s, you either were working or you were looking for work, or you had better have a really good excuse, like being completely, totally physically incapacitated. It was if you weren't working and not looking for work at that age group, you were a bum. Your parents would tell you that. Your siblings would tell you that. Your wife, if you had one, would be appalled at it. That was all very simple then.
And again, November 21st, 1963, the state of religion in this country, or religiosity.
That's a strange story, because the church attendance had been going up since the 1920s, and it reached its apogee around the early 1960s.
Across denominations?
Across denominations. I'm talking about Christian attendance. And so it was very high at that point. Now, we don't have good numbers breaking down social classes and religiosity, but if I had to take a rough guess, you had about, well, we know for the whole population, it was about 50% said they had attended a worship service in the preceding week. That'll give you a sense of the degree of religiosity that existed then.
And the religiosity is also connected to some basic sense of, you use the word often in the book, morality. These days, of course, we talk about ethics rather than morality.
Yeah.
You quote, for example, the motion picture code as it existed in 1963, quoted in Coming Apart. Motion picture code by which the major studios abided, quote, the subject of abortion shall be discouraged, shall never be more than suggested, and when referred to shall be condemned, close quote.
Taken for granted. You also did not show unmarried couples sleeping in the same room or any other way suggest that premarital sex was okay. Now, there were some movies in the early 1960s, including some I love, like Tom Jones, which got away with transgressing that code.
They were pressing the boundaries here.
Yeah, they were pressing the boundaries, but that was the way it was supposed to be back then.
Segment two, Belmont and Fishtown. In Coming Apart, you present two fictional neighborhoods having described the world in 1963, just before the assassination of John Kennedy, and having established that there's a widely shared set of cultural norms that you refer to as a civic culture. You then describe the present day and present two fictional towns, Belmont and Fishtown. Everyone in Belmont has been to college and works at a prestigious job. Everyone in Fishtown has no more than a high school diploma and works in a blue-collar or low-level service job. And your argument is that whereas lawyers and factory workers in 1963 inhabited the same America, Belmont and Fishtown are today might as well be in different worlds. You want
yes.
to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. As I mentioned in the previous segment, marriage in Fishtown is now down to 48% of adults ages 30 to 49 who are married. About a third of all males in that age group, white males in that age group, have never been married. And with that kind of change goes a collapse in other things as well, because we know that men perform a lot better in the labor market when they're married. It's not just that women choose men who are likely to perform well in the labor market. Men do better, as George Gilder instructed us many years ago, when they are civilized by marriage. Social capital collapses.
Social capital means what?
Social capital means all the thousands of things that used to characterize this unique American culture, whereby people living physically in proximity acted cooperatively to solve their problems and help each other.
You knew the widow across the street, so you shoveled her driveway in the winter.
Precisely.
And she looked out for your little kids when they're playing in the front yard and you're busy in the back of the house. That's neighborliness.
That kind of thing. And also more substantive forms where the guy next door has had a rough patch, has lost his job, is looking for a new job, and the neighbors step in and help sometimes with money. Where all sorts of problems are solved without the bureaucracies, but it also includes the ways that parents get involved in schools, fund drives, going to city council to lobby for a four-way stop sign, that kind of thing.
By the way, you should describe Belmont and Fishtown are based on what?
Belmont refers to Belmont, Massachusetts, which is an affluent suburb of Boston, whereas it turns out, I didn't know this, Mitt Romney lives. And Fishtown refers to a neighborhood in Philadelphia that's been a white working class neighborhood probably since the Revolution.
All right. marriage in Belmont and Fishtown. Contrast those two. Fishtown, you've already said
48%.
Mm-hmm. And Belmont is still
84%.
All right.
And not only that, divorce is down. So you've got a very large proportion of those which are first marriages, you know, intact families.
Charles, is it fair to say the 60s come along and swamp Fishtown, whereas Belmont experiments with divorce and cohabitation and the sexual revolution, but then says, well, enough of that?
You know, that just fits the data really well, because marriage in Belmont declined until about mid-1980s, and then it stabilized. And with a variety of other things, it's as if the upper middle class kids had a real great time during the 60s. And during the 1970s, it got a little sleazy, and maybe they began to wonder whether this is really the right way to spend your life, and they straightened out. A lot of social norms at that point still remained in the following sense. We weren't prepared to call kids born out of wedlock bastards anymore, but it still remained that if you were an upper middle class young woman, it wasn't the done thing to get pregnant and have a baby. Plus, you had a lot of aspirations with your life that would be impeded by that. You move down to Fishtown, they had the same experience in the 60s and 70s, but the social norms there did collapse. The stigma against such a thing as having a baby out of wedlock went away, and women in Fishtown didn't have nearly the same kind of future to protect. So it's as if the upper middle class has the resources to rebound from foolish behavior in ways that Fishtown did not.
Mm. Industriousness in Belmont and Fishtown.
Industriousness, probably the signature characteristic of Americans over history. This is what the world has marveled at. 1960, everybody worked. Males worked. 2010. No, let's do 2008 before the recession hit, because this has nothing to do with the recession. By that time, about one out of eight males, white males in Fishtown, was not even looking for work. They were out of the labor market, including during the 1990s when jobs were everywhere. These are not guys who are saying, boy, I'd really like to get a job. They're guys who are living off their girlfriends or off their parents or off their siblings. They're guys that are in the underground economy. It is a fundamental breakdown among a minority of males in Fishtown in industriousness.
Religion in Belmont and Fishtown?
Fell like a rock.
In both?
Well, it fell in both pretty severely. The United States has had a great increase in secularism across the board. But, and here's the surprising thing, it was always higher in the upper middle class than in the working class. Sort of goes against our intuitive understandings. And mind you, when I say upper middle class, I'm not talking about the elite, which I think in some later segments we will talk about. I'm talking about the top 20% of the population. By the time you get to 2010, you're looking at a proportion of people who report that they both attend church regularly and have a strong affiliation with their faith that is down to one out of eight people in Fishtown, which means really they're such a small minority at that point, they're increasingly seen as oddballs.
Right. Segment three. How did this happen? In Coming Apart, you identify specific developments that have created, quote, a new upper class that increasingly lives in a world of its own, close quote. One factor that you cite is, again, I'm quoting you, the increasing market value of brains, close quote.
The central thesis of the bell curve, which Dick Hernstein and I published almost 18 years ago.
Are you kidding? I would have said
10. 18, yeah, it's
my
18
goodness.
Years. And that is simply a phenomenon that has permeated the advanced West, and for that matter, the advanced Asian countries. Mm-hmm. It is simply a lot more valuable, let's say, to have very high ability in mathematics than it used to be. I mean, what could you do if you were a pure mathematician in the 1920s? You could become a college professor.
Teach.
I will give you a whole lot of quant funds that will make you rich beyond your wildest dreams if you're a fine, pure mathematician today. That's one example of many whereby brains are worth more in the marketplace.
So smart people pull away from people of average and below average intelligence.
Fostered by a couple of other things, which is in the 1950s, what I call the college sorting machine kicked into high gear.
Right.
Harvard in 1952 was a place with a lot of rich kids and a few smart ones. by 1960, it was a place with a lot of smart kids and a few rich ones. And that was going on in Yale, Dartmouth.
The SAT sort gets established when? When do the fancy schools begin?
The 1950s. I have the specific numbers in the book, but average Harvard freshman's SAT verbal score went up by more than 100 points over that period.
All right. And then, to me, the most striking factor that you name, homogamy. Or is it homogamy? I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. Homogamy. Homogamy to you. So explain what you mean by that.
Used to be that people got married and they were looking for people that they loved and got along with and people who got their jokes, but they were fishing in a very small pool. So the really bright guy who gets to be rich probably either married the girl next door before he got rich, who's likely to be of fairly average intelligence, or he got married to the woman he meets at the country club after he gets rich, who also is not particularly likely to be bright. Who does that same person get married to today? He's been to Harvard, and he's been to Harvard Law School. He's practicing law. He marries the woman that's across the table for the other law firm, and she has an IQ of 135, too. And this has been going on a huge scale. And that means we don't need to argue about genes versus environment here. For whatever reasons, it is a statistical reality that there's a strong correlation between parental IQ and child IQ. So they're passing down their talent along with their money, and that creates a new kind of stability to the upper class that we didn't have before.
It used to be the case, centuries ago, medieval time, when there were sumptuary laws, that you could tell an aristocrat because he dressed differently. Uh-huh. Walk into a room, we peasants would be seated here, and the aristocrat would come in brightly colored silks. And now the new upper class is smarter.
It's smarter.
Former White House Press Secretary D.D. Myers appearing recently on This Week, quote, "Why is it that the rich keep getting richer? Either the rich people are really a lot smarter than the rest of us, and I don't think any of us would stipulate that, or there might be something in the rules that's rigged and that the government can do something about," close quote.
Yeah. Well, I've got news for her. If you look at the percentage of students who get over 700 in the SAT, what we used to call the SAT verbal or math tests, which we really have to do if you want to have a fighting chance to get into an elite college. The percentage is in the book. It's either in the high 70% or the low 80% of kids who get those high SAT scores are from the upper middle class. And it's not because they take test prep courses. It is simply a reflection of the degree to which the upper middle class is beginning to dominate the smartest kids.
I'd like to come back to the university system a little bit later, but fundamentally, the elite schools at which the enshrined value is diversity are, in fact, factories producing a new upper class.
Yeah, and the problem is that a lot of what they're doing is admirable in the following sense. If you are a bright kid from a disadvantaged background, whether you're white or black or Asian or whatever, the odds are you're not only going to go to college, you're going to go to a really good college. That's good. You know, my father didn't go to college, even though he was real smart, because he didn't have the opportunity. So you've had something that is in the classic meritocratic mode, rewarding ability, but it produces these unintended outcomes that are also very powerful. So what are you going to do? Should we tell Harvard and Yale you've got to admit a whole lot of less talented kids? That won't really solve anything. Because we also know from other studies that kids who get turned down by Harvard and Yale but had test scores and things good enough to get in, they've been tracked and they do just about as well as the kids who got into Harvard and Yale. It's talent.
Keep that. Don't clue Harvard and Yale in on that. That the $250,000 degree doesn't actually make that much difference.
Yeah, it really doesn't. Yeah. It really doesn't.
All right. This is all very hard to take. Cheerfully, we move along. So brains, fancy educations, and intermarriage account for this new upper class.
And a shared culture that they have developed.
All right. Give us a word or two on that.
Well, look, we all have, you know, there's always been the potential for shared tastes and preferences that were different among Harvard students, let's say, we'll stick with that example, than the population at large. But they didn't dominate the environment. So even when I was there in the early 1960s, you step outside Harvard Yard and you were in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was essentially a lower middle class town.
Tip O'Neill represented them in Congress, and he fit Cambridge better than you did.
Yeah, and so we were cheek by jowl with that community as soon as you walked outside the door.
Irish-Italian, right, all right.
And as you had more and more people move into Cambridge because it was a cool place to live with around Harvard, so forth, they established dominance in that area. You go to Harvard Square now, and believe me, what you find is not a five-and-dime store outside the gates of Harvard Yard. You find lovely little boutique shops and every kind of restaurant you can imagine and lovely hotels.
Every parking
and all
meter taken by a Lexus
yeah.
or a Mercedes.
So you have a culture which differs from the rest of America in just about anything you can name. TV. The average American watches 35 hours of TV a week. In the new upper class, they like to brag off and they don't even have a TV anymore. Or if they do, they use it to watch DVDs or Downton Abbey or the NewsHour or something like that. But I could list everything from the average weight of members of the new upper class compared to the average weight of Americans. They're much skinnier. To the kind of beer they drink, to the way they raise their children, there is a distinctive culture. And by the way, I'm not talking about left versus right here. I think, Peter, both you and I are guilty of living in that culture as well. Maybe I do you a disservice by
saying that. I feel an urge to defend myself.
But you're in Palo Alto.
Oh, but wait a moment. Hold on. Charles, in Coming Apart, this is the moment to talk about the bubble. In Coming Apart, you have a wonderfully engaging and amusing test, self-test. Do you do this? Do you do that? Have you seen this television program? Can you identify this pop star?
Have you ever held a job that caused a body part to hurt at the
exactly,
end of the day?
Exactly, right. And then, depending on your score, this shows how completely you're inside the new upper class bubble. Dr. Murray, my score was 64. What was yours?
Rats. Because I think mine was only 48.
There we go, you see.
But you notice...
I have had body parts hurt because I worked construction for a
summer. Yeah, notice, however, that these two members of the new upper class are immediately comparing test scores. So, you know, we don't escape, no matter how hard we try.
So what accounts for this new working class? What's going on in
Fishtown? You know what? I deliberately do not deal with that in the book, and there was a reason for that. The problems we're talking about are not ones that are going to be solved by the right fighting against the left. We need a cultural readjustment in which the left must participate. And I believe there is a potential to engage them. I'm not going to engage them if I do a reprise of my arguments in Losing Ground.
Okay, so for example, Nicholas Confessori, reviewing Coming Apart in the New York Times, writes... In this book, quote, you will learn about working class laziness, but you will find little discussion of the decline of trade unions or the rise of a service economy built on part-time work without benefits, close quote. And your answer is, Mr. Confessori, we'll get to that fight, but not now. I want the data to be understood. Is that correct?
Yeah, and let's say that the left is completely right and that we have demoralized men out there. You know, they've lost their... The manufacturing jobs and the rest, and they're stuck with this lousy set of jobs. Suppose the right is completely right, and an argument says it's feminism which destroyed the male role. That's, I don't care which one is right. If you have a 35-year-old man who is sitting at home in a time when jobs are plentiful everywhere, it doesn't make any difference whether he's demoralized because of the loss of labor unions or demoralized because of feminism. He's still sitting at home. The title of the chapter is Industriousness. And he is not behaving as industriously as his father and grandfather did.
All right. Segment 4, Why It Matters. Coming Apart, quote. You've established that it matters to somebody who's wasting his life sitting at home on the sofa watching soap operas. You make an additional and larger argument here. Coming Apart, quote. The trends of the last half century matter a lot. Many of the best and most exceptional qualities of American culture cannot survive unless these trends are reversed. Close quote. I'll come to a few specifics in a moment again, but explain that thesis. Explain that assertion. Really very aggressive, intellectually aggressive assertion. Explain that.
Let's talk about the functioning of a free society, because that's what I go back to. The founders were unanimous in saying this constitution will not work with just any kind of population. The population must possess certain virtues. And this was
virtues.
Not, virtues. Virtues. This is not just one or two founders who said this. They all did. And they also focused on four that were crucial. All of them agreed. There were others that they, you know, had in the list, but these four were central. The integrity of marriage, industriousness, religiosity, and plain American honesty. And they said, you know, without those, you cannot have a self-governing population. The trends that I describe in Fishtown are in effect saying that the virtues required to be a self-governing community are slipping toward a tipping point beyond return. And at that point, we will have a permanent lower class that is different in kind from a lower class that the United States has had before, in that it is both sizable and it is no longer participating in American institutions. So you will have an upper class that will still be living a fine life, and the middle class will be doing fairly well, but something very fundamental to the common, the universality of being an American, the embrace that it intended to have of all people, that'll be gone. And that is going to be a huge loss. It's also going to induce the creation of an extensive welfare state far beyond the one we have now.
From Coming Apart, a few statistics, Charles. I'll just run through a few of those you present. Voted in the presidential election, down 22% from 1960 to 1996. Attended a public meeting on town or school affairs, down 35% from 1973 to 1994. Served as an officer of some club or organization. You talk about the Elks and Rotary and so forth. Local organization, down 42% from 73 to 94. Percentage of parents with children under age 18 who are members of the PTA, down 61% from 1960 to 1997. And these statistics tell us what?
Well, these come, by the way, from Bowling Alone, the excellent book written by Robert Putnam about a decade ago. They represent across the American population those reductions. The question then arises, well, were these evenly split across?
Right.
They were not. So that these reductions are concentrated in Fishtown, in the working class community. And what difference does that make? Well, the social capital, because that's the social scientist's phrase for it, is another word for what has been the glue of American community, which has been the spirit and the vitality of American community. And that goes away. And it's all linked up with the other trends that we've discussed in previous segments. Religiosity. Who accounts for these wonderful kinds of social capital? Robert Putnam says about half of all social capital comes directly from the religious population, and even more comes from it because religious people are more likely to be engaged in secular forms of social capital than non-religious people. So you're looking at a real mess focused on Fishtown, not in Belmont.
Coming Apart, quote, "The big question is whether the remaining levels of social trust in Fishtown are enough to sustain anything approaching the traditional expectations of American neighborliness and local problem solving. It is hard for me, Charles Murray, to envision a revival," close quote. Now, when I read that, this is a very imprecise parallel, but it gets at something. At least it helps me crudely stumble toward a question that I think is worth asking you to address. If we think back to New York City, even as recently as the late 80s and 90s, and you remember the crime, the feeling that the rich folks on the Upper East Side were okay, but you get out to Queens and you get into Brooklyn and people were living by themselves, locked up behind mm-hmm. their apartment, and New York has been transformed.
Yeah, it has been.
So is there a parallel? Of course, New York isn't Fishtown. I understand there are differences, but mm-hmm. there's an example of a revival of a kind. Does it have a wider applicability?
Well, let's take the case of the real Fishtown in Philadelphia. Because there's a wonderful PhD thesis that was written serendipitously. I had no idea it existed until I'd most of the way through the book. which describes what's happened to crime in Fishtown. In the 1960s, I'm smiling because what happened, if there was any crime in Fishtown, is Fishtown took care of it itself. It was so tight-knit that everybody knew if anybody did something, and they didn't bother to call the cops. Right. But
that's a form of social capital.
Absolutely.
Right.
And what they did not involve a polite lecture to the...
Actually, on New York, long ago in a former life, I worked on a little television crew, and we got stuck waiting for a trial in Manhattan to end. Mm-hmm. And so my buddy, the cameraman from Staten Island, took me to Little Italy and showed me where he grew up. And he said, in those days, you couldn't walk down the street without a curtain flicking. And if you didn't belong in the neighborhood, everybody knew who you were. And within a moment or two, somebody came up and asked your business.
Yeah.
Now, that can be taken too far, but it's social capital, right?
It's social capital.
Right.
But putting it less threateningly, it's also true that your kids could be playing out in the street. And you didn't need to worry that you weren't watching them all the time because there were neighbors who were keeping an eye on them. And if your child did something wrong, you also gave carte blanche to your neighbors to discipline that child. When you lose social capital, the doors have to be locked. The kids can't play alone in the street anymore. And whereas New York City is a good example of life becoming really much safer for the upper middle class in the cities, but it had never been dangerous to the upper middle class in the suburbs. In the fish towns, crime is still violent crime is about 4.7 times higher than it was in 1960. It's come down a little, but it's qualitatively different and worse than it was in the 1960s.
Mm. Segment 5, how not to be another Rome. In Coming Apart, this is a slightly complicated point to set up. In Coming Apart, you begin a chapter with a comparison with ancient Rome, and of course I thought, oh, I know where this is going, Gibbons and the decline and fall of Rome. That's not what you did with it. 5 centuries, you note, before the fall of Rome, before the barbarian invasions from the north, 5 centuries beforehand, Rome took, quote, its initial downward step, its loss of the Republic, when Caesar became the first emperor. Was that loss important? I'm continuing to quote you. Not in material terms. Rome, of course, remained an empire for 5 centuries.
It grew.
It got richer. Mm-hmm. But for Romans who treasured their republic, it was a tragedy that no amount of imperial splendor could redeem. The United States faces a similar prospect, remaining as wealthy and powerful as ever, but leaving its heritage behind. Mm-hmm. Charles, explain.
We've been talking throughout these conversations we've had, Peter, about America's civic culture. Well, when you think about American exceptionalism, what are people really talking about? Why is it that people all over the world looked at the United States and said we were different? Well, some aspects were the land of opportunity. You could go to the United States, you could make something of yourself, and your children could live a better life than you did. But another aspect of this exceptionalism was people would look at us and see the way that Americans solved problems and helped each other at the local level, and it was very close to unique. There are all sorts of cultures that have very strong traditions of hospitality to strangers or hospitality to guests, period. You try to find cultures in which people who just happen to live near each other voluntarily help each other. That is really rare. In fact, it's so rare that I think the word unique is really close to applicable. We had that.
We had it early. Tocqueville, the
famous quote about Americans forming associations at the drop of a hat. Tocqueville's Democracy essentially describes America's civic culture, and it conforms to the kinds of characteristics that I've been describing. But that persisted. Marvin Olasky, in his book, The Tragedy of American Compassion, published many years ago, has this wonderful compilation of organizations in New York City from the churches, from the Protestant churches. And it's talking about dozens of centers for educating disadvantaged children. You can go through, it's just an incredible inventory of things that were done, and that's just the Protestants. Leaves out the Catholic diocese and all of the stuff it was doing, the Jewish activities, leaves out all the secular. It's this cornucopia of stuff that was going on.
And one reason you feel this so deeply is that you experienced it.
Yeah, I lived in
small town. Small town Iowa. It was small town Iowa.
15,000 people.
All right.
And I experienced exactly that kind of civic culture that has existed there. But I want to emphasize, Peter, it also existed in neighborhoods in large cities. So it's not urbanization that prevents this from happening. It is other kinds of causes, but whatever those causes may be, that civic culture is unraveling mostly in one segment of American society. So this has been a long, rambling response to your question.
I find it all alarming and moving.
But it's why we're losing something that is irreplaceable.
And you identify the difficulties in Fishtown, folks who are not getting married, who aren't doing well, many of whom are out of the workforce. And then you say, is there hope that the new upper class, these people of unprecedented wealth and privilege and education and brains, will do the decent thing and try to redress this? And you know what? You're not at all sure.
Yeah, I'm not.
In Coming Apart, quote, my proposition is that the hollow elite, imagine working through 4 years at a fancy school and then getting called hollow by Charles Murray. My proposition is that the hollow elite is as dysfunctional in its way as the new lower class is in its way. Personally, and as families, its members are successful, but they have abdicated their responsibility to set and promulgate standards. Close quote. Well, explain yourself.
We are now in the age of non-judgmentalism. You go to any college campus and you try to engage the students there in a discussion of right and wrong.
And excuse me, Dr. Murray, you mean appropriate and inappropriate.
Inappropriate. Or, you know, relative to the situation that right. And who are we to prescribe to others? Well, here's the problem. Every vital civilization, and I'm drawing actually on the work of Arnold Toynbee here, who wasn't right about everything, but I think he was right about some very important things. Civilizations.
Toynbee is a famous historian who compares more than 20 civilizations across the long sweep of history. The works...
Ten volumes for the whole thing.
Early 20th century?
Mid-20th century.
Mid-20th, all right.
Yeah, and it's an incredible work of erudition. But anyway, he says, look, the sign of a growing culture, a vital culture, is a dominant creative minority, as he calls it, who set the tone. And the rest of the society follows along. Mm-hmm. And this creative minority is confident, it's energetic. And then when you have a declining civilization, the creative minority becomes a dominant minority, still runs the country, but it no longer has the confidence in its own rightness and of what it's doing. And that's what I think I see happening in the United States.
Okay, so fumbling around to understand the argument, a couple of examples come to mind. One in its way commendable, the other not commendable ever. And the one that was for a time in its way commendable is the British, 19th century British.
Mm-hmm.
Think, make what you will of
Absolutely.
Colonialism, there's verve and self-confidence, and then by about the 30s, they've lost their own self-confidence.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's what you mean.
It's one of the most dramatic examples, and Gertrude Himmelfarb's book, The Idea of Poverty, is a wonderful source for this. The British upper class, no, not the aristocracy, the upper middle class.
It's the colonels, not the generals.
The Victorians. The Victorians.
Right.
They propagandized the whole country into buying into their system of morals. And as a result, you had this incredibly rapidly urbanizing society, which actually experienced falling crime during the same period of its most dislocating urbanization. When you presented a letter of recommendation when you were seeking a new job, it was called your character.
Queen Victoria, we have in her diaries, one of the first diary entries after she becomes queen at the age of 18, she writes, I will be good. I will be good.
Peter, I'm so glad you used that word because it brings out another point I want to emphasize with the hollow elite. What do we teach our children now? We teach them to be nice. We teach them to share their toys, not to hit each other and so forth. The idea that being good is a thing that you aim toward with all of the self-discipline, the thinking ahead to long-term consequences, and the rest that being good requires.
The remorse, which you rightly experience when you've done something bad.
Something bad. All of these things are not part of the raising of our children. We want them to be nice. Being nice is a way of moment to moment not creating trouble. It is not a way of inculcating standards of behavior that will get you through tough times. And that's a major part of the hollowness of the elite.
Coming apart, quote, here's the way to solve the problem, quote, over the course of the 20th century, Western Europe developed an alternative to the American model, the advanced welfare state, that provides a great deal of personal freedom in all areas of life except the economic ones. You write that more and more Americans, including, quote, prominent academics and the leaders of the Democratic Party, close quote, believe we should embrace the European model, improving life in Fishtown by expanding the welfare state. Well, why not? The new upper class has gotten so rich. Tax them a little more. Just take care of people in Fishtown.
Right. What harm can that do?
Yes. Well, what harm can it do?
It goes to the pursuit of happiness. And if you take happiness seriously as a concept, and I use Aristotle as my guide for that, you're talking about lasting and justified satisfaction with life as a whole. And you ask yourself, now, what is it that gives people lasting and justified satisfaction with life in a whole? And it has been my argument that I've been writing about for many years that basically you've just got four domains within which that happens. And those are family, faith, community, and vocation. Now, you don't have to...
Vocation meaning something a little larger than job.
Yeah, well, in most cases, it's the work you do for a living. But I will also include avocations with that, or causes. But I'm saying that's basically all there are. And that in order for a person to pursue happiness, those institutions of meaning, if you want to use that phrase, have to be rich and vital. Well, how is it that a family is rich, the family structure is rich and vital? It's because the family has things that won't get done unless the family does them. There has to be responsibility placed on the institution called the family to make it rich and vital. Same thing goes with community. Same thing goes with all of them. And what the welfare state does, in my view, and I reserve all of this for chapter 17, so that my friends...
You don't pick a fight until the last moment.
My friends on the left can read the whole book, and I tell them you are absolutely free to read everything so far and say what he's really done is make a case for a redistributionist state. Okay, that's fine with me. But in chapter 17, I say the problem with the welfare state is it drains the life from life. It, by trying to smooth over the bumps, trying to lend a helping hand, it inevitably takes away the stuff of life from these institutions. And those are as essential for a person in Fishtown as they are for a person in Belmont.
So what do we do? What's the Marie
Kondo? You would ask that, wouldn't you? Everybody wants to know the solution. Well, I will tell you what the solution is not. It is not a system of domestic service where we draft all young people and send them out to mix with each other. That won't work. It's not a renewal of the draft. It's not government regulations.
You're not going to force these two cultures to mix.
It's not a matter of just me being a libertarian and horrified by that prospect. It's a matter of me, who made his living as a program evaluator, saying, ain't going to work. Here's what has to happen before we even have a chance at a solution. We have to have a cultural shift in our attitude toward what's going on. That means, for example, for the people encapsulated in their enclaves, their super rich, super well-educated enclaves with their own culture.
The super zips.
People the super zips.
The super zip codes.
They've got to figure out, do you really want your children to grow up as hothouse flowers? Do you really want your children to be unaware of this rich panoply of life that is out there in America that right now they have not an inkling about? And if you don't want that, there are things you can do. I won't try to go into the specifics. I did it by moving to a town of 270 people. That worked pretty well. No, I'm sorry, 170 people. That worked pretty well, but you don't have to be that extreme. We have to have, for something like births to unmarried women, sort of as a natural statement that journalists make when they write articles about problems of disadvantaged neighborhoods or whatever, that in fact being born to unmarried women causes all sorts of problems for the children in their future life, independently of poverty and independently of parental education. That has to be in the air. Not, you don't have to demonize women who have babies out
but
of wedlock.
That's just telling the truth.
You just got to tell the truth about the costs associated with that. So there has to be a cultural shift. The cultural shift will not occur until we are all contemplating the nature of the problem, and that is what I've tried to do in the book.
We support Obamacare? That helps?
No, you know.
You don't want to be dragged into the current.
That expression on my face.
You don't want to be dragged into the current mud fight.
Yeah,
no,
but, you know, Obamacare is ancillary to the kinds of things I'm talking about. As I think a lot of
people. It is a symptom.
Yeah, it's a symptom of the increasing welfare state, but whether Obamacare is repealed or not repealed is going to twiddle at the margins with the kinds of dynamics I'm talking about. There is almost no direct, immediate, concrete policy implication of the book. There are huge implications for how we need to think about the nature of the problem. And I think of the book as starting the conversation. Or I'd like to think that it starts hundreds of thousands or millions of conversations, even though that's a little overambitious.
Charles Murray, author of Coming Apart, would you close our conversation today by simply reading a passage from your book?
I would like that. Thank you, Peter. A man who is holding down a menial job and thereby supporting a wife and children is doing something authentically important with his life. He should take deep satisfaction from that and be praised by his community for doing so. If that same man lives under a system that says the children of the woman he sleeps with will be taken care of whether or not he contributes, then that status goes away. Taking the trouble out of life strips people of major ways in which human beings look back on their lives and say, I made a difference. Raising a family, supporting yourself, being a good friend and a good neighbor, learning what you can do well and then doing it as well as you possibly can, providing the best possible framework for doing those things, is what the American Project is all about. When I say that the American Project is in danger, that's the nature of the loss I have in mind, the loss of the framework through which people can best pursue happiness.
Charles Murray, author of Coming Apart, thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
For Uncommon Knowledge, I'm Peter Robinson. Thank you.